It's easier to talk about issues like the global food shortage in global terms. That way, the cost of something like rice and the effect on people is not so personal. But zero in on one small restaurant in Port-au-Prince, in Haiti. The man who runs it is Alex Toyo. He says that since the price of basics started going up, the number of his customers has gone down, and his own family is eating its way through the restaurant's reserves. Haitian life is hard, he says, especially when you try to lift yourself up by starting a small business.
Haitian life is hard to become something even you would like to. But, you know, Haiti is a problem country. It's a trouble country. You know, you're never stable. That's why sometimes it's hard for you to become something, you know?
These days, Alex is no longer trying to become anything more than just a man who can provide food and school fees for his sons. Even that for him is out of reach. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
More and more these days, the daily news stories about politics and war are being pushed aside for stories about the one thing that is essential to all of us, and that's food. These are the news items that focus on corn and wheat, and most often on rice.
It's a food that's a staple for half the world. And its price has gone up about 50% in the last year. The cost of rice is spiralling out of control, and there are worries about what will happen next.
What started to happen next began about 6 weeks ago with civil unrest in places like Egypt and the Philippines, and in other countries much closer to the US.
In Haiti, the poorest country in the Western world, people vent their anger on the streets. Most of the population live on less than $2 a day. And over the last year, the cost of basic food like flour has doubled. The protesters are demanding the government either helps them or stands down.
When those food rioters charged through the streets of Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince, Alex Toyo was in his restaurant. He was watching through his doorway as hundreds of the protesters gathered, or as he says, manifest in the streets. That day, he says, he locked the door.
I was obliged to close because when I saw the manifestant people coming to me, and then I was closed the door.
Did you think maybe you were in some danger?
Yes, of course, yes.
Did anybody do any trouble to the restaurant? Did anybody throw anything at the restaurant or try to break in?
No, they just passed by, but I was afraid and I just closed the door without nobody seeing even if I am inside. That was happened, let's say, during 2 days. The population getting angry.
Is it the same for you? Do you see the price of food going up too much?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, for me also. Yeah.
Alex Toyo used to be a tour guide in Haiti. That's why he knows English. But when the tourists stopped coming to Haiti several years back, he had to do something. So he opened a small restaurant. He named it after his wife, Ma Rosa Toyo. At the beginning, it worked out pretty well. Alex cooks simple foods, Haitian specialties.
I serve chicken, goat, pork, shrimps, conch shell, and fish.
I wonder if you can do a favor for me. People will be listening to our conversation on radio, and they won't really know what the restaurant looks like. If I stepped in the front door of the restaurant, what would I see?
Well, if you come by in my restaurant, you're going to see a door with a glass in it, let's say over 12 tables.
And 12 tables, 4 chairs each table, so you can seat maybe 50 people?
30
people?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And when was the last time the restaurant was full?
December 24th, for Christmas time. And the other time, it was Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day.
It was full.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was full also. Since that, it's not really full like I would like.
I should tell you how I spoke with Alex Toyo. There's a reporter who works with Reuters based in Port-au-Prince, and he agreed to record Alex's voice while the two of us spoke over the phone. He then sent us the recording of Alex's answers, and we put the conversation back together here in our studio. That's why you can hear the sound of traffic and generators and roosters in the background. Alex tells me that his own costs have gone way up in recent months. Alex used to buy his rice in 10-kilo bags. A year ago, that bag cost 250 gourds, or about $7. Now it is four times that price.
I think now it's almost 1,000 good.
So can you even afford to buy the 10-kilo bag anymore?
Yeah, if I buy it, I will have problem to resell it because they don't really have opportunity to buy it from me.
You mean you have to charge more and the people don't want to pay that?
Yeah, of course, yes, yes.
It sounds like it's been pretty tough for you in the restaurant.
Of course, it's very hard for me then. I don't make enough, really.
But you stay open?
Yeah, I'm still open.
Do you eat in the restaurant yourself, you and your wife?
We do, but not big meal. Rice and bean and some French potatoes.
But you don't eat the chicken, you don't eat the shrimp, you don't eat the goat?
No, because it costs much more.
And you have children, Alex?
Yeah, I have two boys.
How old are they?
One is 17, one is 14.
And where do they go to school?
Well, they are in the Catholic school.
Does that cost you money?
Yeah, that costs money because I have to pay every month. 3 months ago, I don't pay yet. And that's why they gave me a deadline to pay. But up to this time, I don't pay yet.
What are they saying?
At the end of this week, if I didn't have a chance to pay, they will send them back to me.
This week?
Yeah. I always, very, very shame for that when that happened. That's really hard, when you have kids to school and they send it back to you.
What are you going to tell the boys?
They already know if you don't pay, they're going to send them back. That happened to many, many Haitian people, every school, I guess.
You talk to your wife about this?
Yeah, she already know. Yeah.
What does she say?
She's always complaining. He don't pay school yet, and then I am eating everything, She said, if you eat everything in the restaurant, you don't have money to go and buy, to resell, that means you're going to close it anyway. That's what she say. Because she complained when I am eating and the boy is eating also.
So what do you do?
Well, what I'm doing, nothing, because I just listen what she's saying,
Do you ever think, Alex, that it was a mistake to open the restaurant?
Well, I don't mean it's a mistake. It's a question of Haitian life. Haitian life is hard to become something even you would like to. But, Haiti is a problem country. It's a troubled country. You never stable. That's why sometimes it's hard for you to become something, But it's not a question of mystic. It's not a mystic. It's only I would like to get a little bit help. I don't find anyone to support me. That's all.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Alex Toyo is not a poor man by Haiti's standards. He runs his own restaurant. But the rising price of food means that people will ask for cheaper prices, or they'll ask to pay later.
If you have a guest coming all the time, they're coming mostly all the time. One day, if they don't have money, they say they're going to eat for credit. You cannot refuse them because they're already, a big customer.
So you have to let them eat on credit?
Yeah, you have to.
Alex, do you know of any people who are having a really, really hard time, people with no food?
Oh, yeah, I know. Like if you should come in Haiti, you could see them and their face. When they pass by and when they're coming to beg, you can tell.
You have a lot of people coming to the restaurant to beg for food?
Oh, yeah, many of them. They're just asking anything you have, anything you want to give, you give. Because it's begging people.
And what do you do when they ask?
If I have a rest of food, some of people eating, and I keep the rest for some of people who need it.
You mean if someone has ordered food and they leave food on their plate, that's the food you give away?
Yeah, they leave some for on the table and I keep it for someone who can eat it.
This happens a lot?
Yeah, that happens all the time. If you know somebody who don't care, then they need the food and you can just leave the food for them, exactly, because you know he come to look for it. More begging now, yeah, for sure.
Alex, what's it going to take to change things around?
I don't know. God only knows. Everybody pray for God, for God to help.
But if you have the price of food that's going up 2 times, 3 times, where's it going to end?
It's one of the problems we have in Haiti. Nobody stop nothing. If something happen like that all the time, people going to still get angry, you know? They're going to take out again.
More riots.
You know? More riots, yes.
Alex, do you know people who have left Haiti?
Oh, yeah, I know many friends. They're living for America.
And what about the boys? Can they have any kind of future in Haiti?
Yeah, one of them would like to be a lawyer. The other one don't tell me nothing yet.
And the one who wants to be a lawyer, is it possible?
If I have a chance to finish them at school, and then they will have a chance to get better life than me.
But you still have to wait and see if the school will keep them, right?
Yeah, because your chance become at school.
You put a lot into that restaurant.
How much money?
No, how much heart? How much of Alex's heart is in that restaurant?
Oh, yeah. Let's say 90% heart, you know?
90% of your heart?
Yeah, of course, yes.
In that restaurant.
Right, yeah.
Alex Toyo runs Maros Atoyo in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Since I talked with Alex, one of his sons has been sent home from school for non-payment of school fees. The restaurant's still open. In just a moment, we'll look at the other side of this coin and the people who are making money as the cost of food continues to climb. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Just a couple of moments ago, I was talking with Alex Toyo. He runs a restaurant in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and he's having a hard time staying in business. The trouble for Alex is the rising cost of commodities like rice. Well, it's a news story we're hearing a lot these days.
Experts don't see any relief in sight. And if anything, expect the prices could double in the coming months for rice, a staple in the diets of nearly half the world's population.
While some people are wondering where their next meal is coming from, others are wondering what each day's news will bring to the international markets. Some people make their living trying to decipher shifts in the change of price of such commodities as rice. John Casey is the Rice Pit Chairman at the Chicago Board of Trade, and he joined me recently at the studios of WBEZ in Chicago.
Turn the volume up on my headset a little bit.
Yeah, we'll send you a little bit more down the line, and that should fix it for you. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's a little bit better.
You're just used to having people shout at you all day.
Exactly. Long. I'm used to having people shout at me, and usually I say I blame it on a Led Zeppelin concert, but today I'm going with the standing around and yelling all day.
Is that what your day was like?
Actually, today was pretty quiet.
I was surprised John Casey was not hoarse from all the shouting among traders in the pit, but he told me that not much of that goes on anymore. It's the kind of work that's easier to do with a computer these days. But John's been there at the Chicago Board of Trade now for over 20 years.
What happened was I went down to the trading floor to visit somebody, and at that point it was an absolute sea of humanity. Yelling, screaming, people going crazy, waving their arms around, and everybody wore different colored coats, and it looked like madness. After I spent a few days down there, I realized, you know, I can make sense of this. Many people spend a long time down there and never make sense of it, but I felt that at the time that I could make sense of it, and I aspired to do that.
And could you choose? I want to be trading wheat. I want to be trading zinc. I want to be trading rice. What?
You know, because of the finances, that is a difficult thing. If you come in the right situation, you absolutely have that, all those options. However, in my situation, I came in without family backing. They certainly did back me, but not to the financial extent that some of the people that you really needed. I mean, I remember one of my father's friends telling me, I'll just ask your dad for $50,000. Now, $50,000 is a lot of money. Today, in 1982, it was unbelievable money.
It was the whole house in 1982.
It was the whole house. And so that wasn't going to happen. I worked for some guys who let me use one of their memberships to trade when I was not working for them. And that worked out. That's really how I started putting together enough money to eventually purchase a seat. And I ended up trading rice as a friend of mine was doing my job of brokering in that pit, didn't want to do it anymore. And I saw it as a reasonably good opportunity and grabbed it.
Do you remember your first day as a rice trader?
Yes. My first day, ironically, was the day of the 1987 stock market crash. So that was trial by fire. The financial world felt like it was melting down. A few pits away was a Board of Trade stock index market. That was, of course, going crazy. Right behind me, there was a phone call with a number of the exchange's board of directors, including a guy who had previously been standing next to me in the pit. And I was on a speakerphone, so I heard both sides of the conversation. They discussed the fact that the New York Stock Exchange was going to be shutting down in 5 minutes. The American Stock Exchange was shut down in 5 minutes. The Chicago Board Options Exchange would also shut down in 5 minutes, as was the Chicago Mercantiles Exchange S&P pit. The board of directors needed to vote on whether or not to shut down our stock index, which closely matched the Dow Jones. It was called the Maxis, is what it was called at that point. These gentlemen, to a man, said, no, we will not close this down. And most of those men walked over and traded in that pit and probably cost them each tens to thousands of dollars.
Just because they stayed open.
Just because they stayed open. And these men wanted to make a statement. Hey, we're here for business. If you want to sell it, we'll buy it. I heard some numbers from some of those individuals, and they lost large amounts of money. But what they were doing was they were keeping the exchange open for business. And a generation before that, a group had done that during World War II. When grain trading was outlawed, there was a group that came down to the exchange every single morning to open the gates and put up prices, to have a cup of coffee, close the gates and leave. But they needed to post a price every day to say that the exchange is still a viable ongoing exchange.
So you're seeing all this crash around you, John. What are you thinking that you've made this terrible mistake in the business?
No, I found it to be extremely exciting.
Well, car crashes are exciting, but that doesn't mean you want to be in the car, you know?
No, that's very true. I was not in the stock index pit. It took a little while for that craziness to move over into the grain pits, although it certainly did. People were getting out of all of their financial positions to pay margin calls. So we saw people dumping out of soybeans, out of corn, out of rice, just at a drop of a hat. They're get me out of everything.
John Casey is the Rice Pit Chairman at the Chicago Board of Trade. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. John says that he has to watch everything from recent cyclones to the start of this year's hurricane season.
Hurricane season starts in June. We've never really had serious hurricane damage, except for after Katrina in Louisiana, and most of that was actually fields being flooded with salt water.
Yeah. But take something like the recent cyclone in Burma, which apparently wiped out a whole lot of rice production. Yeah.
Yes, it wiped out their rice production. It wiped out their rice storage. It went through an area with grain production, storage, grain elevators in there. That's a disaster for that country. The Bangladesh went through something similar last winter.
So what happened in the markets? Give me an example. Did the market start to shift when the cyclone was still at sea? How did that track?
No. The market actually, because there is such a dearth of information coming out of that area, the market did not really react for a day or two. I saw that on a Sunday night, and I believe it traded lower that evening and didn't start to really gain traction for a couple of days.
And did it go up a lot?
Yes. Yes, it went up $2-3.
And what about the earthquake in China? Would that have an effect as well?
That is one that we're really that is having an effect, and that's one that it's difficult to make heads or tails of. It's tough getting information out of China, reliable information, anyways. Our thought right now is it's going to affect demand. There'll probably be increased demand. Rice is easy to cook. It's easy to transport. It can be brought into these areas that have been devastated. So we expect to see more demand. China might need to come into the world markets if they need a dramatic amount of rice.
John, when did you start to see a change in the price of rice?
It really wasn't until late last fall and early this winter that the market really started to take off.
And what were you thinking at the time? What was going on? What was going on behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes, it was kind of alarming looking at the report last March saying, hey, if we have weather problems here, we're going to have some real serious issues here with the price, especially in Asia, where they don't have the transportation and some of the storage that we have in America.
By last March, do you mean March 2007?
I'm sorry. Yes, March 2007. Yes, I should have been more
clear.
The
reason I'm curious about this, John, is that really if you go by what we hear in the radio and what we've read in the newspapers, this global food shortage issue has really only hit the headlines just in the last couple of months in 2008. But what you're saying is that the groundwork for this was being laid over a year ago.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And really, the stocks to usage ratio had been moving towards even for a number of years.
I mean, how much is there to be consumed and how much is actually being consumed?
Yes, exactly. We were in surplus for a long, long time. We weren't seeing the growth in production, whereas we were seeing a growth in usage.
Now, you manage a hedge fund as well. Is that right?
Yes.
So were you at the time when rice was starting to tick up, were you thinking, this is a good place to put some money?
What we did was some of our customers and potential customers telling them, hey, you may want to play this. This is something you want to watch. And that's a good thing to do for potential customers, I'll tell you. So tell them something that's about to explode and double in price.
Give them some good advice and they'll
come
back again.
Give them some good advice for free, too.
How about you? Did you invest?
Oh, yes. It would have been very frustrating to stand in the pit every day and watch that market go to skyrocket.
And are you still heavily invested in rice now?
I am not, actually. I got out a few weeks ago and I'm looking to wade back into that market. But I should have sold it when I got out of the rice that I had bought. But alas, I did not. And I'm looking for price to get back into the long side of that market.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. John Casey had been tracking the situation in the Philippines. They lost that crop due to drought last year. They'd been seeking large quantities of rice for the best deal. The prices were getting dramatically higher, but then something changed. John says one story persuaded him that the rise in prices might be at an end.
It was a Wednesday a few weeks ago. One of my partners, after the close, said to me, hey, did you see this article about the Philippines? And I had not. I was busy. He showed it to me. And what the Philippines government had said was that they would get all of the rice that they had wanted, which they had not for some time, at a price that was cheaper, which did not seem plausible. So as the two of us looked at it, we thought, hey, this must be a nation-to-nation deal that's already been set up. All they have to do is ink the paper. That was the first thing that I looked at thinking, maybe this is time to take profits. I'd been kind of looking for a place to take profits anyways. And it's tough to find a place to do that as you're in new territory. We had never traded these prices. So there is nothing to look back at and say, hey, the last time we went to $25, look what happened. That just did not exist.
Yeah.
So I looked at this and thinking, maybe tonight during the overnight trade, I'll get out of my position. And as I was standing on an L-stop, I pulled out my iPhone and there was an email from an old girlfriend of mine who lives outside of Boulder, Colorado. And she asked, what's going on with the rice? My friends are asking me about the rice. And I told them I have a friend who's a rice trader. So what's up with that? And I thought, if they know it about this outside of Boulder up in the mountains, they know it everywhere. And it's probably all over. That's what really convinced me. That was the nail in the coffin. And I got out that night. It continued higher during that evening, but has since gone dramatically lower.
So you made a good call.
Yeah, I did. I told her I owed dinner. A very nice one, too.
Love those old girlfriends.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
And what do you see ahead? Because, it's for those of us who don't look at it from the perspective of, commodities traders. There's so much doom and gloom about, you know, an increasing food shortage. I mean, just widen your vision for a bit beyond rice to talk about everything in the all the grains that you're looking at. What are you seeing there?
Well, the American farmer and farmers in general are awfully productive. These situations do happen occasionally. We had dramatic shortages in 72, 73, 74. The world is going to have to adjust to China and India's newfound prosperity, and I'm sure that we will. As you look at, say, Vietnam, they have a problem with getting people out into the fields to pick the rice because the factory jobs pay more. Well, they're going to have to mechanize. And at some price, they will. We're used to cheap food. We've been spoiled by cheap everything. And as China comes into the markets, all of these markets, we've seen how dramatically they change it.
So this interests me. After 20 years in the rice trading business, and now you're Rice Pit Chairman at the Chicago Board of Trade, you're an optimist. You actually think that, you know, if there's a shortage, people are just going to find ways of growing more. That it's not necessarily as dire as we're led to believe.
I do not believe it's as dire as some people are saying. The human spirit is tough to put down. And I'll tell you what, we like to eat.
John Casey is a rice trader, and he's based in Chicago. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. You know, I've talked with a number of people recently on The Story about their first time voting. Phyllis Barnwell is one of our listeners who heard my request for more such experiences, and she wrote in with her story. Phyllis grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut. She admits that she was a somewhat unusual teenager, because back in the 1940s, at a time when other 14-year-old girls were perhaps more interested in boys, she was more interested in politics.
I guess I was pretty talkative. And we would have these groups as if we were really great voters. By this time, I had talked my dad into changing from being a Democrat to a Republican.
Oh, you were a young Republican, were you?
Yes, that's what Pepe Reps meant.
Pepe Reps?
Yes, that's what I was a member of, the Pepe Republicans of the future.
Phyllis used her own political smarts to help her father get elected as the first African-American sheriff in Norwalk. But her favorite memory of those days was the first time she voted.
I voted on my birthday. My birthday was November 4th, 1952. I was 21.
But if you turned 21 on voting day...
Yes.
Could you vote on that same day?
That's what I fought for. And having been a member of Pepe Reps and having made these connections, we really had to put up a good reason why. I went to register... And I told
before your birthday,
before
right?
my birthday, yeah. When the very last day of registration, I went in and I will be 21 on, and they were sorry because I had to be 21. And I said, no, I have to be 21 to vote. And I had looked up, it did not say I had to be 21 to register. However, their instructions were I had to be 21 and be able to prove it. And so my dad and some other people went to bat for me. And there was
you got the grown-ups and the Republican Party
yes,
going for you, did
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. And there was another young man whose birthday was the same as mine. And
yeah.
I think he would have been satisfied to wait until next time. But I wasn't. And they opened up the registration at 7 o'clock on November 4th, the day of election, to register the two of us.
You mean they opened up registration on
at
voting
City
day
Hall.
Just for you?
And Galvin.
The other young man.
That's right.
Had this ever been done before?
No.
So you were making a little bit of history there.
I think so.
Phyllis, think back to that time for me. Was it because you wanted to vote, Or was it because you wanted to vote for what would have been Ike in 52,
I
right?
I like Ike. I had a rhinestone pin that said so. I still have that.
The I Like Ike pin. So you actually wanted to vote for Ike, and you were determined to do it. So determined that what did you do? Did you go to court to get them to open the registration?
No, we didn't go to court. At that time, we didn't have primaries. We had caucuses, and it started at one of the caucuses. And I'm not sure what the words were. I just know when I got the call and I was told when that they were going to allow me to vote, I could register. And I thought I was going to go that day. And they said, no, not until November 4th when you're 21. And part of it, I think, was that whoever was involved in planning this wanted to have the newspapers there for this.
So Phyllis Barnwell had her gloves on and her hat and a special dress for November 4th, the day she turned 21, and the first time she voted, back in 1952. Her picture did make the papers, but she also set herself on a life of political activism that brought her into close contact with the leading feminists of her day, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as well. More on that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. For the past little while, I've been asking you for your stories about the first time you voted and why it might have made a difference to you. See, I'm interested in knowing about those moments when politics really touched you. Phyllis Barnwell was telling me that she'd grown up immersed in politics. She was a young Republican at the age of 14. Her father was the first African-American sheriff elected in Norwalk, Connecticut. And then, as it turned out, the day that Phyllis turned 21 was voting day, November 4th, 1952. The officials told her that she couldn't register and vote on the same day, so some heavyweight Republicans intervened, and she not only managed to register and vote on the same day, but she had the newspaper people following her.
It was written as if it was our determination to vote.
Kind of in a civil rights way?
Yes, I guess so.
Because this is 52. This is a long time before the civil rights fight
exactly,
of the 60s, right?
Exactly. I wasn't planning to picket or anything, but I didn't have to say what I'd do if they didn't, because they did.
Did they put your picture in the paper?
Uh-huh.
Can you describe what you looked like in the picture?
We were standing. They were at this long table, which is not where we registered, but they had this long table. And there were two people sitting down who, you know, with the big books out. And the mayor was at one end, and two or three Republicans were, you know, kind of around us. And all of their names got in. And by the way, our name was there also.
What did you look like in the picture?
Young. Oh, my, I looked so young.
Were you all dressed up for this?
Yes, yes, you dressed up for everything then. You know, I had on gloves, white gloves.
A hat?
Yes, yes, a hat.
Why did this matter so much to you, Phyllis? Do you remember?
Well, after all those years of working and hoping that people would get up and get out and vote, it was my turn. I didn't think it was fair that I had to wait in order to vote. It would be 4 years before I could vote for a president again. And, of course, they're going to have an election for something else, but that would be a year from now. But I'd been waiting all this time.
I'm just doodling on a piece of paper here to figure out how many elections ago that was. And it's 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 presidential elections since then. Have you voted in every single one of them?
I have voted in every election for anything, wherever I was since then. I've never missed an election.
Phyllis Barnwell went on to a lively and politically active life. She met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at a New York seminary in the early 60s. He came to speak there, and Phyllis went to hear him with her husband, David.
I was not totally in agreement with Dr. King, and I discovered that I liked him very much. He was a gentle, very nice man, but I wished he had been a little stronger, pushier,
Gosh, this was a guy who was at the front of the marches, you know?
And, you know, when you look back at things sometimes, when you are so gung-ho and kind of young, there are things, Superman kind of things that you want. And I look back now and feel that it's not possible to have been any stronger than that man. But at that time, I couldn't stand the things that I was reading in the paper. I couldn't stand the deaths of those young people that happened. And I really can't tell you what I expected him to do, but I just wanted him to stop being so loving and kind. I wanted him to be angry. I wanted him to say that God does not like ugly, and that's ugly. And he never said things like that.
Did you tell him that?
No. I wish I had.
Did you talk to him at all?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I saw him again at Riverside Church. Oh, that was powerful. And that was the night then he said something about the war and how much he was against it. And he had not said that before.
This was the first night he spoke publicly against the Vietnam War.
Exactly.
We still have a choice today. Nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion.
Do you remember what you were thinking, what you were feeling when you heard that?
I was crying. I was weeping because I was glad he finally said it. And I couldn't imagine that he could feel any other way, but he wasn't saying it.
That would have been the time when a lot of people were turning against
him. Yes, exactly.
Against him. What was the mood in the church that night? Can you describe it?
I believe that everyone knew what he came to say, and so that very liberal church was packed with people who came to rejoice.
White and black?
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. It's an interdenominational, interracial church, and it was packed. And this was some years later, and he remembered me.
He did.
I can't remember what I talked to him about because I was in awe of him. But David and I had been sitting in the stairwell because we couldn't get in the church, and there was a stairwell going up to the balcony, and we couldn't get up to the balcony either. We were sitting in the back. And on his way out, he was being ushered by all these people. And he stopped and he spoke to us. He remembered us. And he said, "How am I doing?"
You realize this was 40 years ago or better. That's a long time ago, but it still seems so clear in your mind.
Exciting things hang in there for you. And that was a very exciting evening.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Phyllis Barnwell went on to spend time with the political pioneer of women's rights, Congressional Representative Bella Abzug. Phyllis says often those meetings were at Abzug's townhouse in New York.
She would meet you at the door wearing a hat and gloves, and she would serve you brownies and coffee or tea.
I imagine the talk was a little more radical than gloves and brownies.
Yes, and it surprised me because I had all read many things that she'd had to say, and but after meeting her, and she had this lovely little very feminine townhouse, and I got to know different people because of these women meeting and planning to start some kind of organization for women. And
this would have been the genesis of what we now know as now.
Exactly. Exactly.
Present at the creation, were you?
Yeah.
Phyllis Barnwell says one of her most memorable political encounters was with Shirley Chisholm. Chisholm was the first African-American woman ever elected to Congress, and in 1972 she became the first to run for president. And when Phyllis Barnwell met Shirley Chisholm, the two women were flying from New York City to Albany on the tiny plane that was used by the governor.
We called it Governor Rockefeller's plane that went from New York to Albany every day, and different people who were going up to meet with him or having had something to do at the Capitol would ride up in this puddle hopper plane. We didn't talk on the way up because you couldn't hear yourself. We had to wait for the cars to come get us, and we chatted.
What did you talk about?
There.
Do you remember?
Women and their place in society And I loved to listen to her talk, and there was a very special, precise way she had of speaking. And it took me a while before I realized that the reason that she spoke so precisely was because she had a lisp. She was very careful not to show the lisp.
She also had a Caribbean education. She had been raised in one of these British private schools in Barbados, yes, or someplace like, yes, that. So that would have given her also a little bit of a...
She also had this wonderful accent, yes. Yeah. Yes. Not deep, but just a lilting
musical
way of speaking, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You must count yourself fortunate to have had these moments with people like this.
Yes, and I think it had to do with the times. I don't think it's as easy to meet and be able to talk with people today as it was then.
What did you talk about, you and Mrs. Chisholm?
Well, the thing that I remember most was her warning me and anyone with a son to remind us that there are many things that men do to hold women down in certain positions. And she reminded me that it's women who train men, and to keep that in mind. We are responsible for a lot of what we are uncomfortable with men.
So I have to ask you, Phyllis, you had this powerful political moment in the Riverside Church with Dr. King and saw what a outspoken African-American leader could do to inspire a nation. And yet you were also a part of the earliest days of modern feminism in New York with some of the most powerful women of that time. And now we're looking at an election which presents Democrats with the option of either putting their support behind a woman or an African American. What does that mean to you?
Probably the most exciting thing I have ever seen. And it's a tremendous dilemma, because I have a lot of respect for Mrs. Clinton and what she's done, what she's able to do, the fact that she's a very bright woman, and I like the way she goes about getting things done. And I promised that I would walk with her all the way. And then Barack Obama came on the scene, and it's a delightful heartbreaker, because at one point I would say it doesn't matter to me which one, because it's both wonderful. But you know, you don't really mean that. There's some part of you that wants one thing more than another, and it depends on which day it is.
Do you really flip back and forth like that?
I have never flip-flopped that much, and I do. I do. And it's for different reasons, because the things that matter to me the most, they are in agreement with. It's just very, very difficult.
You are now a Democrat, despite the fact that as a 14-year-old, yes, you were a peppy Republican, right?
And I was a Republican until I came to North Carolina. At first, I said I was not going to affiliate with either party. And the lady said, "Are you sure? Because then you can't go to primaries here." And I said, "Okay." So I said, "I'll register as a Democrat."
60 years, though, in politics for you. You realize it's been 60 years.
Now that you say it out loud, yes.
I think that's a badge of honor.
I do. But what I'm saying is, now that you say it out loud, yes, now I realize it. But I hadn't thought of it. Some things, it seems like 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And it's not. It's a long time ago.
And so as you look at your party wrestling with this choice,
mm-hmm,
are you feeling like when the decision is finally made and whoever makes it, something's going to be lost? Is that what you're anticipating? Or are you feeling that when the decision is made, something will be won?
Both. Both. Something is going to be won. But there's going to be something lost also. But hopefully not lost forever. Just for now. I have asked myself, if someone told you to write down and they wouldn't look at it until you left the room exactly what you wanted, would you be able to? And I wouldn't. I would not be able to. I'm glad I don't have to make the decision. I made my decision to vote in the primaries, and now there's no question about how I will vote in November, but it's a little painful for me.
I can imagine. I can imagine. Because you fought on two fronts.
Yes. Yep. You didn't ask me what the subject of my speech was in 1949.
This was your
high school public speaking contest that I won.
Do you remember the title of the speech?
Absolutely. A Woman for President.
Did people take you seriously?
They thought that was the silliest subject going.
In 1949?
Yes.
What did you say?
I said, I believe that it will happen. And that may be a part of what's happening with me now. I thought I would be able to stand up and write some of the people who are left and said, I told you so.
You realize that in 1949, if you'd written the other side of the current Democratic dilemma, you'd have been writing not an African-American for president, not a black for president, but a Negro for president,
that's right.
And what would people have thought? Would they have thought that just as absurd?
I would never have ended up in the finals of that public speaking contest. I do not believe I would have ended up in that contest.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you do?
I won.
What did you win?
$25.
This is a lot of money in 1949.
Yes.
Phyllis Barnwell joined me in the Story Studios here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. If you have your own story about a moment in your life when politics made a difference, when it touched you, doesn't matter where you are or when it happened, you can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. I recently had a conversation with two women who worked for a chicken processing plant in rural North Carolina. Emma Pender worked at that plant for 24 years, Rita Perry for 4. The one thing they both remember was how important it was for the company to keep the line running no matter what happened.
One man was cutting the chickens, they pulled him down, he cut his finger off, and it ran down the drain, and they had to try to catch it so they could get his finger out.
And reattach it?
I guess.
Did they get the finger?
Yeah, they did. Because, see, the drain was like maybe about two feet wide. Mm-hmm. And the water was just continually running because they had to run water all night long under you washing the floor down. You had to make sure that the meat was off of the floor. Then when he had cut his finger, it just went down in the drain. And they had to try to help and catch it.
When this fellow lost his finger on the cutting machine, did they stop the line then?
No. No, they did not. I believe that probably if I had rolled down that dead, they probably wouldn't have stopped it then.
Long enough to get you out of the way, then start back up.
We got a number of letters and calls after I talked with Rita and Emma. Vanessa also worked at the same chicken plant, and she called to say she thought the stories of the two women were, in her words, completely true. There was some speculation in our earlier conversation about what new employees are paid now. Vanessa told us that she started recently at $8.50 an hour, and then after 3 months her pay was raised to $9.75 an hour. Bill from Oxford, North Carolina, wrote about how much this chicken plant story reminded him of Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, where an immigrant worker from Eastern Europe comes to Chicago and works in the meatpacking industry. The book caused public outrage at the hygiene in the packing industry and led to the passage of pure food laws. Bill wrote, unfortunately, it didn't do as much as Sinclair had hoped to bring about change in working conditions. I guess that like now, Americans were more interested in the quality of food rather than the quality of life of the people and the animals that contribute to that. Antoine from Omaha wrote to say, my mother worked for Tyson Chicken in Pine Bluff, Arizona for about 25 years, and the stories I remember my mother telling me about working conditions were similar. They were also pressured by the company to avoid joining a union. The factory was eventually closed, and the workers were given a ridiculously low severance or a choice to relocate to the newer factory, also in town. Antoine says his mother opted to move to the new factory, where she lost
pay as well as her job seniority. She now works for the USDA as an inspector for a chicken factory in Washington. Well, how about you? If you have a story of a working life that you think needs to be told, you can get in touch with me by leaving us a short message on my telephone at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or just leave us a message on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.